Take your Bibles, if you will, and turn to Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5. We are continuing in the Sermon on the Mount, the longest recorded sermon of the Lord Jesus Christ. Sometimes we feel like we fail. Sometimes we feel like we fail time and time again. Now, I don't mean that in something that we're trying to accomplish, something that we're trying to do, that I'm trying and I failed and I'm going to try to do it again. But I mean something that we've made a mistake in, or some type of sin that we've committed. And we do it over and again, over again. And each person, including Christians, seem to have some particular thing that they are tempted by, something that they really struggle with to overcome. Sometimes it's not unlike an alcoholic who, whenever they're close to a drink, they're going to drink again. And for each person, each Christian, it seems that has something like that, where it's something that they're just, it's the hardest thing for them to resist. Whether it's a gossip or whether it's lying, whatever the case may be, I'm not specific, it's not necessarily the specific sin that I'm speaking about, but it's this idea that we fall into it time and again. And there is a difference, however, between the alcoholic or the drug addict and the common churchgoer. And you say, well, what's the difference? Well, the sin of the addict is clear. It's understood. It's something that you can identify without a problem. You say, yep, that's their problem. That's their issue. I used to work in a homeless shelter, and within the first moments that I met a man, I could almost identify that's the issue that man has. Because that's the issue that almost all of them had, was either alcohol or some type of drug addiction. For a churchgoer, it's not quite the same. It's sometimes hard to identify what that besetting sin is, that difficulty that they struggle with. Now, I'm not saying that they're a hypocrite, which is acting and saying one thing and doing something else. Because people fail. We're not perfect. Even those that trust Christ are not perfect. But I'm talking about falling into sin through some type of temptation. And the question that I would have for you is, do you have something like that? Do you have a particular sin in your life that you struggle with? Something that you say, I wish I was different in this thing. It's something that I've done time and time and time again, but I don't like it about myself. Whenever I'm through it, I always feel horrible that I actually did it. Well, have you thought about that particular sin, and how do you combat that sin? How do you go about removing that sin from your life? How do you go about removing the things that brought you to that sin? Have you investigated it? Are you even willing to investigate it to see if you want to be different? And as we look at the Sermon on the Mount tonight, those types of questions are what you have to have in the back of your mind as we go through it. How does it apply to you? How does this work out practically in your life about sin? Not, you know, I can't say a particular sin, but sin in general, because each one of us are sinners, regardless of the sin that we commit. It's who we are. So in this portion of Scripture, it's in Matthew chapter 5, verses 27 through 30. It says, "Ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, Thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. And if thy right eye offend thee, pluck it out and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into hell. And if thy right hand offend thee, cut it off and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into hell." Those two things don't seem like they really fit together. The two ideas here about adultery, and then the idea of plucking out your eye and cutting off your hand. But hopefully as we go through this, you'll see how they really do fit together. That Jesus is, again, expounding and expanding our understanding of the law. Understanding of what God was saying when he gave the law. But again, we want to keep this in context. We want to keep these verses in the context of the sermon that Jesus was preaching, because that's taking me quite some time to go through it. We don't want to lose that context, because Jesus, remember, preached this at one time, at one sitting. And so remember the Beatitudes, the statements that he made in the very beginning of the sermon. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Remember that this is a portrait that Jesus has painted in these Beatitudes of what a Christian looks like. They're not something to say, I'm going to follow these things to become one. It's what one looks like. They should be poor in spirit. They should be humble. They should mourn over their sin, over the sins of others. They should be meek, and not putting themselves first, but putting others first. They should be hungering and thirsting after righteousness. They should be hungering and thirsting after those things which are right and good. They're merciful. You know, when you think about it, a Christian is merciful because they've been shown mercy by Jesus Christ. They're pure in heart. Well, you start to recognize that these things can't be natural in man, because no man is pure in heart in the natural sense. It's got to be something that the Spirit of God does through the birth of the Spirit, through the blood of Christ. They're peacemakers. We talked about that weeks ago, about what a peacemaker is. It's someone who is actually sharing the peace of God through the gospel of Jesus Christ. And only a Christian can do that. And then the idea that, what happens to that? What happens to a Christian? Well, how do people react to a Christian? Well, they say they're nice. They enjoy their presence. They enjoy when they're being nice to them. But a lot of times they're persecuted. The world persecutes them because they're different. Because they don't necessarily tolerate sin. They don't tolerate certain things. And they say, Jesus Christ is the only way. When men want to say that there's all types of ways that someone can go to heaven. And so the world persecutes them. But then what kind of influence does the Christian have in the world? Well, they are salt. They preserve it. They preserve society. They keep it back from some heinous sins and crimes that can be committed. And they're also something that gives it flavor, that gives life meaning. You think about life without Christ, it's difficult to find that meaning. That's the influence that they have, and then they're the light of the world. They point the way to Jesus Christ. They shine that light on Him. Not upon themselves, but upon Him. And then Jesus talks about the law, that He is the fulfillment of it. He is the fulfillment of what we read in Exodus chapter 20. He is the only fulfillment of it, and the only way that we can fulfill it is through Him. Because the standard that He sets is so high. Again, we talked about this before. In verse 20, this is the leaping off point for the rest of the sermon. The Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus says, "For I say unto you that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the Pharisees, the scribes and Pharisees, he shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven." That's the standard. It's better than the best. It's better than the best example you can think of. That's how you have to be to enter into the kingdom of heaven. It's perfection. And of course, we all understand that we can't attain to that. We're not going to be perfect. We didn't, even if we started right now and were perfect for the rest of our lives, we still have the blot of sin on our lives. We still have to say we're sinners. Perfection is unattainable. But that's the requirement of a holy God to enter into His heaven. And so Jesus, to press home this point, talks about the law. And He talks about the law from the Pharisees' perspective, and then starts to tell us what the law truly means. And then the first time He says it, He's talking about those that are angry with their brother in their heart, without cause. And He says, that's equivalent to murder. That's equivalent to murder. And He expands upon thou shalt not kill to not just be the action of killing, but about the heart attitude, about the things that we do with inside, the motives, the things that we are tempted to do and think about doing, and yet society forbids us of doing them. And He says, those things are equivalent to murder. And then He comes down to these verses here in verse 27 and 28. Ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you that whomsoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. And again we notice this idea where Jesus says, you have heard that it hath been said by them of old time. but I say unto you. And he's contrasting what the Pharisees say with what he says, what the law truly says, what the law truly means. He's comparing it. He's comparing what they say and what he says. And you say, well, you read Exodus 20, and it does say, thou shalt not commit adultery. And that's absolutely right. But see, the Pharisees, and we're not given it here in Matthew 5, but the Pharisees had restricted that to the act of adultery. And that only. And so they said, I can stand here and I can say, I fulfilled the law because I have not committed that act. And there were civil penalties for the act of adultery in Israel. And they said, okay, this is the act of adultery. Here's the civil penalty. As a Pharisee, I can say I have not killed, I have not committed adultery. I've never done that act. And it has nothing to do with the heart. But Jesus is saying it has everything to do with the heart. You see, Exodus 20, it's telling us it's got to do with thou shalt not commit adultery. But what does it say in verse 17? He says, thou shalt not covet. That's a heart matter. How can anybody legislate covetousness? How could you do it? Well, I can say Elijah is coveting something that Malachi has. Well, how do I know that? I have no idea. That's something that's in the heart of each one of us. There's no way to outwardly identify it unless he acts upon that. But see, the law covers the heart, not just those outward actions. Not just the act of adultery, but it's looking upon a woman in lust. And the Pharisees, by restricting it in that way, they've made it just this small negative. Don't do this, or this will happen. But Jesus is saying the law is broader than that. The law is so much broader than that. And not only that, the law is a positive, not just a negative. The law is a good thing. And we talked about this some last week. It's a positive. You love the Lord your God with all your heart. Love your neighbor as yourself. That's the fulfilling of the law. That's what Jesus says the greatest commandments are. Those things of love. Love is a positive, not a negative. And that's the fulfillment of the law. Well, how do you say that? Well, thou shalt not commit adultery. How can I not commit adultery? By loving my neighbor as myself. I'm going to treat him better than I treat myself. That's going to keep me from that sin. You think about Psalm 1 and the idea that the delight is in the law of the Lord. It's something that makes somebody happy. You hear about legalism. You hear about the religious groups that follow sets of rules that are so specific. And you say, if you haven't done this, and you haven't done this, and you haven't done this, you're okay. Well, those people aren't happy. Because they're always constantly saying, I can't do this, I can't do this, I can't do this, I can't do this. No, but the law of God is a positive. It frees you not to do those things, but to have joy in the fact that Jesus Christ has fulfilled those things, and you can change the way you behave towards others because of what Jesus Christ has done. Because of the love that he's shown while we were enemies with him. And so they made this law of adultery, they made it attainable. It didn't matter if they didn't actually commit the act to them, as long as they could look at a woman. You know, I can't tell you how many times throughout my life I've heard men say, you know, as long as I don't touch, it's okay. I can't tell you how many, even my own brothers have said those things to me. They think it's okay as long as they don't do the act. But Jesus says, no. No, even if you just look in lust, you've committed the act. It's equivalent. You've committed that sin. And you say, well, how do you know they made it attainable? Well, you look at John chapter 8. In John chapter 8 it says, and early in the morning, he, speaking about Jesus, came into the temple. And all the people came unto him, and he sat down and taught them. And the scribes and Pharisees brought unto him a woman taken in adultery. And when they had set her in the midst, they said unto him, Master, this woman was taken in adultery, in the very act. Now Moses in the law commanded us that such should be stoned. But what sayest thou? They said this, tempting him that they might have to accuse him. But Jesus stooped down and with his finger wrote on the ground, as though he had heard them not. So when they continued asking him, he lifted up himself and said unto them, He that is without sin among you, let him first cast a stone at her. And again he stooped down and wrote on the ground. And they which heard it, being convicted of their own conscience, went out one by one, beginning at the eldest, even unto the last. And Jesus was left alone, and the woman standing in the midst. You see, they combined those two things. They combined the civil law, that had to do something with adultery and said, this is the result, adultery, you're going to be stoned for it. And they combined it with the moral law. Well, the moral law is so much broader than the civil law, because man can't judge the moral law, because it's a heart matter before God. And so they've done this, when they confine the law to that specific act, then it becomes attainable. I can do that. But Jesus is teaching us that it's not attainable. It's not something that you can go through your life and say, no, I've not committed that sin. I'm not perfect. I'm not that way. But right before this, he says that we have to be better than the scribes and Pharisees. We have to attain to a better righteousness than they had. And he's showing us that we can't. They're quick, very quick to point out other people's sins, aren't they, the Pharisees? And you see this so much in so many people that live by sets of rules. They'll say, that's wrong. That's wrong. And they'll completely point it out constantly, time and time again, for the wrong reasons. You know, it's okay to call sin sin, but don't do it in a way to judge the person. Do it in a way to help the person out of it, to stop doing it, to change who they are, to change what they are. Not to just judge them and throw them into the court system and stone them like they were going to do to this woman. And you see it again in Luke chapter 7, verse 36 through 39. It says, and one of the Pharisees desired him that he would eat with him. And he went into the Pharisee's house, speaking about Jesus, and set down the meat. And behold, a woman in the city, which was a sinner, when she knew that Jesus sat at meat in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster box of ointment, and stood at his feet behind him weeping, and began to wash his feet with tears, and did wipe them with the hairs of her head, and kissed his feet, and anointed them with the ointment. Now when the Pharisee, which had bidden him, saw it, he spake within himself, saying, this man, if he were a prophet, would have known who and what manner of woman this is that toucheth him, for she is a sinner. See, that Pharisee was judging that woman by the acts that she committed. He never understood that the law told him that he was a sinner, because he had confined it to these specific things. That here he is, he's judging Jesus to not be a prophet because he supposedly doesn't know. And if you read the rest of that portion of Scripture, it says that Jesus did know who the woman was, and Jesus even knew what the man was thinking in his heart. But Jesus is merciful to sinners. And see, when we live by sets of rules, when we are legalistic, when we have to accomplish certain things to be a Christian, then all of a sudden we're going to be doing the same things that the Pharisee did, trying to make things attainable for ourselves. And there are so many groups that try and do that. The Catholics try to do that. The Muslims try to do that. They try and make heaven attainable by following these guidelines, these rules. And if you mess up, well, then you can come and listen to this man and he'll forgive you. But see, Jesus is saying it's completely different than that. It's not these sets of rules. It's so broad you can't attain it. It's only through me that you can attain it. It's only through my blood that you can attain it. So he says that, no, it's not thou shalt not commit adultery. It says you shouldn't even look at a woman in lust. And you think, well, what is he speaking about? He's talking about the broadening of that commandment. He's expanding our understanding of it. He's not creating a new law. He's just helping us understand the law that's already there. So what's the responsibility? The responsibility of men is not to look on a woman in lust. You know, here's something that we need to keep in mind is all kinds of things will come into our head. It's especially true of men. All kinds of things come into our head. But the question is, do we dwell on them or do we push them aside? Do we push them out? For a man to look on a woman in lust is adultery. It's fornication, it's sexual sin, just by looking and dwelling and thinking upon that. Well, what about women? You say, well, it says, thou shalt not look on a woman. Well, there's responsibility of women too. How does a woman dress? How does she present herself? Does she present herself in such a way that men will be lustful when they look at her? It's a two-way street. You know, I constantly think about, we had a couple of exchange students. And one of them from Spain, I constantly told her about the way she dressed. That the way she dressed was attracting men's attention in the wrong way. It made men think in a certain way of her. And that she was going to have a hard time getting around that. She ended up having a boyfriend. And that's the way the boyfriend thought of her. Because that's the way she dressed. That's the way she presented herself to him. It's not just men looking in lust. It's women dressing to have men look in lust. It's something in our society, and where does it come from? It comes from our heart. These actions come from what we think, what we see, what we do. They're all tied together. You know, you say, well, how are you saying it's not just this sexual idea? Well, because of what Jesus says next. He goes on, he says, if thy right eye offend thee, pluck it out. Pluck it out of your head and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into hell. So what's he saying? You know, there in the history, in church history, you study, and it's kind of sad and funny in the same sense. There were actually many, many different people that thought they should go around mutilating themselves. They would cast out their right eye. Well, casting out your right eye doesn't do anything for you because you still have the left eye. Actually, plucking your eye out doesn't do anything when you can actually still look with your left eye in the same manner that you were looking with your right eye. Cutting off your right hand doesn't help you any if you still have your left hand to do the same sin. These are statements that Jesus is making about what we should be doing about sin in our life, and not just about sexual sin. See, the right eye, in Jewish terms, the right eye was the eye of strength, just like the right hand was the hand of strength. Whenever you hear any story in ancient cultures, who is the most powerful man in the kingdom? Well, the king was. And who was next? He was the one sitting on his right. And as seen throughout the Bible, at the throne of God, the right hand of God, the power. It's always the right hand. The majority of people in the world are right-handed. It's that same sense. That's why he's using this idea that this is the most important hand to you. Well, if there's something that's going to keep you from heaven and send you to hell because you constantly use this hand, get rid of it. Whatever that thing is, get it out of your life. In James 1, here's the idea that Jesus is saying, if thy right hand eye offend thee, pluck it out. James 1 says, let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempteth he any man. But every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. Then when lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin. And sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death. How many times in our lives have we committed sin, committed an act, a physical act, because we saw something that we shouldn't have seen? That we knew when we saw it, we shouldn't have seen it. We allowed it to come in through our eyes, and it dwelt in there. Dwelt in our hearts, dwelt in our minds. And sin committed was committed before we ever actually even did the act. And then we did the act. That's what Jesus is talking about. You know those things that happen, get rid of the thing that's causing it. If you know you have a weakness, get rid of it. If you know you have a weakness for something that you watch, get rid of it. If you know you have a weakness of lusting after a woman, when you see her, don't look. Turn your head the other way. There's no need to watch. There's no need to look. But those things are hard to do. He says, if thy right hand offend thee, if thy right hand is leading you to sin, cut it off. These are the actions. Now the eye is talking about what's inside of you. You're seeing it. You're thinking about it. You're dwelling upon it. Well, the hand, it's just the action. You're doing it. Something is leading you to sin. Cut it off. Get it out of your life. Get that object of strength, even though it's one of the most... My right hand, I couldn't do anything with my left hand. I couldn't do anything. If I lost my right hand, I'd be in trouble. But he's saying no matter what it is, it could be the most important thing in the world to you. If it's causing you to sin, take it out of your life. Because it's better for you to be without that and go to heaven than to have it and go to hell. And that's the idea that he's giving us here. In 1 Corinthians chapter 9, it says, but I keep my under my body, this is Paul speaking, bring it into subjection, lest that by any means, when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway. This is Paul speaking. He's saying, I do my best to control my body. Where I go, what I do, who I listen to, what I see, I control my environment so that I keep sin from it as much as I possibly can. That's hard work. That's hard work, especially in today's world. So much we see on TV, so much we see in advertisements, so much we see around us, the way people dress on the streets, you name it. It's hard to do that. But just because something is hard doesn't mean it shouldn't be attempted. Doesn't mean it shouldn't be tried. Romans 13:14, but put ye on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh to fulfill the lust thereof. See, sometimes when we have those sins that we talked about in the beginning, we make provision for that. We allow it in. We say, you know what? That's not so bad. And we put ourselves in situations that will lead us to sin. And most of the time it comes through our eyes, dwells within us, and then goes into our hands and we act upon it. And that's where sin comes from. But Jesus says, how do you apply this? Well, Paul tells us in Hebrews 12, saying, wherefore, seeing we also are compassed with about with so great a cloud of witnesses, all those that have gone before us. You know, there's people that have lived the Christian life throughout the centuries and have done it successfully. And it shows us that we can do it successfully too. You look at, Paul specifically speaking about the honor roll of faith in Hebrews 11, all those prophets in the Old Testament, Moses and Abraham and Rahab and Elijah, and then you think about those in the New Testament, Stephen who is martyred, and so forth and so on. Well, all these people are objects to say they made it. They're witnesses that this works. That the life dwelt in Christ through the blood of Him works. And he says, because we see so many that have lived this life, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us. You know, when you're running a race, you don't run with weights on. You try and run, I've run cross country, I've run many a race throughout my life. You try and run with the lightest shirt you can wear, the lightest shorts you can wear, the lightest shoes you can wear to get you through the race. You don't want any extra weight. I'm always fascinated by these people. You see them in the Olympics sometimes, and they're wearing these great big gold chains as they're running down the track. I'm thinking, any weight that's going to slow you down, take it off. Well, that's what the writer of Hebrews is saying. That's what sin is. It's holding you back. Well, get rid of the things that cause you to sin. And let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before Him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. The idea here is get those things out of your life. They're causing you to sin, remove them, so that it doesn't hamper you in your run, in your race. We have to remove these things. But see, here's the idea. If you just remove those things, it doesn't mean sin isn't going to come in some other way. Say, well, what's the solution? You know, it's fascinating. I've had five older brothers, an older sister, and my parents, and none of them are Christians. Growing up, there was all kinds of things that they got into. I'm the youngest in the family. And boy, I saw so many examples of the things you shouldn't do. Shouldn't do this because that's a mistake. Because I saw the result of what happened to my brother Jim. That's a mistake because I saw what happened to my brother Tony. That's a mistake I saw what happened to my brother Tom. That's a mistake I saw what happened to my brother Bill. My sister Sherry, she messed up doing this. My mother, she did this. My dad, he did this. And those were good examples for me of what not to do. But it never taught me what to do. It never showed me a good example of how to live. And you see, the Bible is telling us the same thing. In Luke 11, it says, when the unclean spirit is gone out of a man, he walketh through dry places seeking rest. It's speaking about an evil spirit. And finding none, he saith, I will return unto my house whence I came out. And when he cometh, he findeth it swept and garnished. Then goeth he and taketh to him seven other spirits more wicked than himself. And they enter in and dwell there, and the last state of that man is worse than the first. You know, it was horrible, horrible to see those men at the homeless shelter. Because I knew when they walked through the door, they're dealing with alcohol addiction, or they're dealing with a drug addiction. And they'll stay for a few days, and they'll be sober. They'll be getting off the drugs. And sometimes they'll enter a program and they'll be able to stay there. And they're staying there for months. And it seems like they're getting their life cleaned up. But they don't trust Christ. And after a little while, they've been working. They're getting their feet back underneath of them. And they say, I'm moving out. I'm going back out. And what would happen within a week? They're drunk again. They're in that drug again. And the fall, when they fall then, is worse than they were when they walked in. And that's the way it is constantly. That's what Jesus is speaking about in Luke 11. When someone, the evil spirit's cast out, but he comes back with more spirits because the man has never been filled up with something else. He's saying that's not the way we ought to be. when we remove these things, these besetting sins, these weights that entangle us, fill them up with something else. Make sure you replace it with something. Philippians 4 says, "Rejoice in the Lord always, and again I say rejoice. Let your moderation be known unto all men, the Lord is at hand. Be careful for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known unto God." Don't worry if you think it's too big or too small. Go to God. Ask Him about it. "And the peace of God, which passeth all understanding, shall keep your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus." Not just your heart, but your mind. It's the thoughts that come in. But then he says, "Finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good repute, if there be any virtue and if there be any praise, think on these things. Those things which you have both learned and received and heard and seen in me, do, and the God of peace shall be with you." It's not enough just to remove things. You've got to fill the gap with other things. It doesn't work just to clean the house up and leave it empty. No, you have to fill it. Well, what do you fill it with? You fill it with the things of God. You fill your thoughts with the things of God. You're taking away those things that lead your eyes to sin, the thoughts, the evil deeds that are within you. Just like lusting after that woman, remove those things. But you got to fill your mind with something else. Fill it with the good things of God. You're doing certain actions that lead you to sin? Well, cut that right hand off. Fill it with something else. Remove those things that lead you to sin and do service to the Lord. Fill it with positives, not just the negatives. See, the Pharisees were all about the negatives. The law says don't do this, and this is the result. Well, Jesus is saying, yes, the law says don't do this, and this is the result. But the law says do this. Love your neighbor as yourself. It's a positive, not just a negative. Romans 8 says, "But if the Spirit of Him that raised up Jesus from the dead dwell in you, He that raised up Christ from the dead shall also quicken your mortal bodies by His Spirit that dwelleth in you. Therefore, brethren, we are debtors not to the flesh to live after the flesh. For if ye live after the flesh, ye shall die. But if ye through the Spirit do mortify the deeds of the flesh, the body, ye shall live. For as many as are led by the Spirit of God, they are the sons of God." You know, the epistles of Paul, the writings of Paul are throughout like this. It's in Colossians, it's in Corinthians, it's throughout his writings. Mortify the deeds of the flesh. Now that's what Jesus is telling us by telling us to cut off the right hand. By plucking out that right eye, mortify the deeds of the flesh. But you have to fill them with something else. And see, Jesus is expanding the law. He's expanding it so that we feel it. We feel its burden to be too great upon us. And it makes us run to Him. Because He is the fulfillment of it. Something that's impossible for us, He has accomplished. He accomplished it through a perfect life. He accomplished it through a sacrifice. His own sacrifice on the cross. And that's what He's impressing upon His hearers. He wants them to understand that this what He's speaking about is beyond them. When He says, you need a greater righteousness than the Pharisees, He's pointing out the Pharisees have failed at the law. Because they've restricted it to just the act of murder or just the act of adultery. But the law means more than that. And to His hearers, that's an important thing to hear. And to us, that's an important thing to hear. The gospel of Jesus Christ has to do with sin. It has to do with the things that we do wrong. That we have to feel the weight of those things to realize that that sent Jesus Christ to the cross. And that we can't attain to God's standard ourselves. And that's exactly what He's doing here. That's exactly what He's doing in this Sermon on the Mount. He's showing His hearers that they can't do it. That it's impossible. It's impossible for me. You know, my family constantly gets it backwards. They think that I'm trying to earn heaven. They think that I'm going to be in heaven because of how good I am. No, that's not the way it works. It's Jesus Christ and His blood that paid the price for me. That's why I'll be in heaven. Because I've trusted Him. Because I have faith in Him that He has died for me. And that He had victory over sin and death, rose from the grave. And that's why I'll be in heaven. And then all of a sudden I understand the law better. I understand the law more fully. And I understand that it's not just a negative about following a list of rules, but it's a positive to love the Lord my God with all my heart to love my neighbor as myself, to do positives, not just the negatives. And when I find a sin, I investigate why I committed it and try and remove it from my life so that I honor the Lord, so that the glory goes to Him, not to me, because He's the one that's made it possible. So think about the sin in your life. Does it cause you sorrow? Is it something that you have sought forgiveness for? Is it something that you've gone to Christ for? Are you born again? Has the Spirit of God dwelt within you? Those are the first questions you have to answer. And then after you answer those questions, if you can say you are a Christian, then you have to start working on removing those things. Now, if you can't answer those things in the positive, then you have to dwell on those things. Because it doesn't make a difference if you never trust Christ. If you never look to Him in faith. So Jesus is teaching us that the thoughts and the motives and the desires of our heart are just as equal as our actions. They're just as important. And again, I ended on it last week and I'll end again on it tonight. How do you fulfill the law? It's only possible through Jesus Christ, because Romans 13 says, "Owe no man anything but to love one another. For he that loveth another hath fulfilled the law. For this, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness, thou shalt not covet. And if there be any other commandment, it is briefly comprehended in this saying, namely, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Love worketh no ill to his neighbor, therefore love is the fulfilling of the law." What's the greatest example of love? It's Jesus Christ. Him dying for sinners. That God reconciled me when I was his enemy. Sent his son to die for me when I was his enemy, to bring me to him. That's love. That's it. That's the example. And you can't do that without Christ. There's no way to love like that without Christ. And that's what we do, is we point you to him. Because that's the only way to fulfill the law, is through him. And it's not through perfection of our own selves, it's through his perfection. Through his glory. And he'll receive it. See, if I could attain to the law like the Pharisees thought they could, well, then the Pharisees receive the credit. If I could do that, I'd get the credit. But no, the credit goes to the Lord. Because he's the one that fulfilled the law. And when I trust him, he gives me his righteousness. He takes my sin upon him. And that's the only way to fulfill the law. And so we point you to him.